Accession number 30284, reel 7.
Well, Nisbet, reel 7.
Right, well, there's one little matter, or quite a large matter, I suppose, that did happen when I was on the squadron, but not with our squadron, but with 22 Squadron. Because what happened was, as a result of this bombing of Brest, the battleships Scharnhorst and Knysna were in Brest, but at some stage the Knysna was damaged by the bombing, and it had to come out of the inner harbour to the outer harbour for some reason. And this was spotted by photo reconnaissance. Now, there was another, well, there were three other squadrons equipped with Beauforts at the time, but one of these 22 squadron had sent a detachment to St. Evil. And the orders were given for 6 aircraft to take off, loaded with torpedoes, and to try and torpedo this Knysna. Well, in the event, I think two of the aircraft were found to be unserviceable. The weather was extremely bad, and maybe that had something to do with it, but only 4 took off. And 2 of those were shot down, and the other 2 could not find the target because of the weather. But we now know that one aircraft flown by Kenneth Campbell, flying officer Kenneth Campbell, did reach the target. He went in at low level and was fired at from the outer mole, and his aircraft was hit. But his torpedo travelled and did successfully hit the Knysna, which very nearly sank. But he was shot down, and all crew members were killed. And this took place on the 6th of April 1941. We heard about it. The first I knew about it was when somebody came in the mess, officer's mess, and said, "That madman Campbell, he's gone into Brest and torpedoed the Knysna, and he's been shot down, blown out of the sky. Now they're going to expect all of us to do the same thing." But anyway, he was awarded, quite rightly, a Victoria Cross, posthumous Victoria Cross. Now, that Victoria Cross was presented to the squadron on the 7th of April 2000 at Saltcoats in Ayrshire. His brother, who was older than him, presented it to the officer commanding 22 Squadron, who at the time was Wing Commander David Simpson. I was chairman of the Beaufort Air Crew Association and went up there for the ceremony and took photographs of it. And it is now probably the proudest possession of 22 Squadron. And that was one episode which took place when I was in the squadron.
Had you met him when he was on detachment down?
We must have been in the same officer's mess, but I didn't recognise him amongst all the others or know his name.
Was there much mixing of the squadrons when they were on detachment?
No, I think this was one of the few occasions when we did had another detachment there. I knew, of course, all the officers on my own squadron. Didn't know the sergeants so well because they were billeted separately. We were billeted in hotels outside the station. We were billeted, first of all, in the Watergate Boat Hotel, and then in the Water Beach Hotel. That's the officers were, and the sergeants were billeted further down the coast in another hotel. So Treyarth and Beach, something like that. But anyway, we lived in quite comfortable circumstances. We had batmen to look after us, although they took them all away after a time, put batwomen in. And we didn't like that so much because they didn't seem to look after us so well. But anyway, we lived in reasonably comfortable circumstances. There's one other little episode that I ought to perhaps mention to you, which took place in the early stage before I was crewed up. And that is that coming back from one of these trips, I spotted some dinghies in the water. There were 2 dinghies, and there were 5 men in them. And this was off the south coast. And we waved to them, or circled around them, but they didn't wave back, and there's a merchant ship nearby. And I signaled to them, pick up those men in life raft. But they signaled back, no. And looking at the life raft, I could see they were a funny shape. And they were more square, ours were round, they were square. And they were off the shore. And they tried to get into the shore, and the surf washed all of them off and drowned them. And I felt very upset about that. And they were Germans, but we didn't feel that was the way they should die. It would be much better if they'd been rescued and be prisoners of war. In other words, we didn't have any real hatred for the Germans, I think, not the frontline fighting men anyway. We hated the Nazis and their foul deeds, although we didn't know too much about them, but we knew they were the... Oh, God. We hated the concept of Nazism. We didn't want the... Obviously, we were determined to stop them overrunning our country. But we had a certain fellow feeling for the German airmen, and they did for us, as I now know, because... I do know from one or two of our chaps who were shot down, they were interviewed by Germans, German people who shot them down, and German chaps who shot them down, and given little presents and so on. It may have been because they wanted to get information out of them, but I don't think so. I think they just wanted to make sure they were in comfortable circumstances, and we felt the same.
In that case, though, was that not something that was shared maybe by the Merchant Navy crew? Or was that an operational thing that they didn't want to stop?
I think they couldn't approach them. I think the waters were too shallow. They couldn't get to them, and they had no facilities for getting to them. It was a merchant vessel, and they may not have had a life... I'd have hoped they'd have got a lifeboat which would have rowed towards them, but they didn't. I think it had just been attacked, and it may have shot down the aircraft, and maybe they thought they would reach the coast, but the surf sort of overcame them and they were washed off.
You know, when you were signalling to the ship, I take it that was with the oldest lamp.
That's right.
How did you do that from the aircraft?
Well, we flew around in a circle around the ship and kept flashing it out. It was fairly...
And you would do that from the nose, would you?
I did that from the nose, yes. I think. Yes, I'd have done it from the nose because otherwise the wing would have impaired the vision. I'd do it better from the nose. But I'd do it pretty quickly. Men in life raft or something.
And just a little bit about the chronology there. How long were you doing the kind of reconnaissance flights without a crew?
Oh, I think for 2 months almost. 6 weeks, 2 months.
And how many, in that period of time, so that kind of period, how often would you be on operations? Would it be once a week or once every 2 weeks or more?
Well, I was in the squadron for doing operations for 10 months. In that time, I flew 50 operations, probably B for 100, gives you some idea. Stand by for much, much longer. And of course, we did have short leaves. There was one little episode in the leave incident, as an officer, I travelled first class. I was tired. I went into the first class compartment, which was completely empty, and went to sleep and stretched myself out. And I woke up fairly shortly, and there were other passengers there smiling at me. And, I was so confused. I got up and apologised. They didn't mind at all. There was another episode, too, where we went into a pub in Newquay, and it was packed full. In those days, pubs were always packed, and a steward tried to stop us going in. And there was a howl of rage. And so we were ushered in, and there was a table for us and four pints of beer.
So at the time there was great support for aircrew, wasn't there, amongst the populace?
Yeah. Without any shadow of doubt, there was.
Were they aware of the roles that you were taking on in that kind of... Because I know at that time, a lot of emphasis was put on in the media, really, between about fighter pilots and bomber crews in that kind of 1941 period. Were people aware of the role the Coastal Command was playing?
Well, they were... There were certainly boys noting everything around the airfield, and one of those boys, Roy Dunson, wrote to me after the war, and he knew what was going on. I think almost as well as we did ourselves. He could see the... I mean, you'll understand that the Spitfires were photo-reconnaissance Spitfires, and they were PR Spitfires. They were taking off from St. Evil, going over Brest and so on, and further down the coast. He would be logging all those, and he'd be logging everything that went on. They knew what we were, and somehow they knew what we were up to as well. So I think we were very much persona grata in the area. And this chap, Roy Dunson, wrote to me and asked me if I would compile the Book of Remembrance for St. Evil Church, which I did on a voluntary basis. It took months and months of work. It was a very complex business, looking through masses of documents at the Public Record Office and then tying them up with other records and so on, and gradually getting all this together. Hundreds and hundreds of names. People were lost, not only British but Americans as well. But I finally did it. Whether it's 100% accurate, I can't be sure, because records weren't kept very accurately at that stage. But yes, and Roy Dunson became something to do with the church there, and eventually the church was dedicated as the spiritual home of the RAF. And so I was involved in those circumstances too.
At the time when you were flying, though, how were casualties seen? Because you were aware of high casualties amongst the squadron, and you that remark that was made, obviously, when Kenneth Campbell went to sea. How were your operations seen? How were casualties seen within the squadron at that time? Was it something that you did think about, or you didn't think about at that time?
Well, I certainly thought about it, because I arrived in January 41, and as time went on, all the others seemed to be lost. And you'd have to be an idiot if you didn't realise that no matter how careful you were, sooner or later, statistically, you'd be one of the next. So it did play on one's nerves, no doubt about it. I can't remember ever being frightened or scared at all in the air, particularly on the run-up to the targets. I was too busy to worry about it. But I suppose there was a certain nervousness before one took off, but I didn't feel that very much. I felt it was more when I got back and was in my bed at night that I realised that statistically I was being very, very lucky, and it was going to be miraculous if I managed to survive the whole squadron. But eventually I was taken off after, I think, about 11 months of flying. I was taken off flying, and that was, I must confess, a relief.
Were you given an operational tour? A length of time that you would have to operate with the squadron?
Yes, there was, and of course this was normally considered to be 200 hours. I think I was taken off at somewhere about 190 or something like that. But the point was that in Bomber Command, that really consisted of 30 operational flights, because these were a longer period. But ours was, our flights were shorter, you know, perhaps on average 350, 4 hours, that sort of thing. So we had to fly close on 50 before we got through our operational flights. And of course, we still had the flak at the end, in the course of those, most of them anyway, apart from the patrols, we did get a lot of flak. And so this is why I think that the Beaufort casualties were even higher than those of Bomber Command, although it wasn't recognised as such at the time. We were the more or less the Cinderella of the forces, and you know, we weren't known so well to the general public. Or subsequently, this business of the maritime operations of attack strike aircraft of coastal command is something which, after the war, I for some reason got roped in to write about. But it was an aspect of the war which was more dangerous than Bomber Command even, and that was dangerous enough. Now, don't misunderstand me. I mean, their casualties were about 66%, ours were about 8%. So, yes, it was a weight on one's nerves, all this business of knowing about these casualties and not being stupid, realising that you were going to be extremely lucky to survive. I felt somewhat ashamed of myself for feeling, having these thoughts, but I still did carry on all the same, and I think did my job, and I now know that everybody else felt more or less the same who did survive, so it wasn't exceptional.
At the time, did you have a fear that at some stage you might not be able to carry on? That you might reach a point where you would have had enough?
Well, I think it was pretty obvious to anybody outside that there was a limit. You needed a rest, a longish rest. And although I did have a longish rest, oddly enough, at a later stage in the war, I definitely wanted to get back on operations. Particularly when we started to win, that's when I wanted to get back. You know, when the forces were with us and we weren't sort of fighting against odds, I wanted to get in on it. Yes, I definitely felt in need of a rest after close on a year in the squadron. Actually, I was in the squadron for over that length of time, but doing some administrative work afterwards.
Did you fly any daylight operations, daylight bombing operations?
Yes, I did. There was one operation in which we very nearly met our end, and that was after a time the squadron moved down to a place called Thorny Island in Hampshire. And although I didn't realise at the time, we were there waiting for the Scharnhorst and Neisner to come through the channel. We had intelligence that would be the case. When they did come through, we were too late on takeoff. Actually, I was duty officer on the station at the time, and I didn't participate in the operation. But there was another episode before that, when we went up to a place called Coltishall in East Anglia, three Beauforts, to attack, go on the daylight raid over the Hook of Holland, the Dutch coast. And I was with Percival, our pilot, and there were two other aircraft with us. We landed there and briefed to go over to the Hook of Holland and make a dive bombing attack on the ship. We took off. We were in the leading aircraft. I was in the leading nose, and we had Spitfires around us. So we felt reasonably secure. Then we found a ship. I don't think it was the one they thought would be there. In fact, it was what was called a harbour defence vessel. But we dived on it and dropped a stick of bombs, and it was firing at us. I could see this flak coming up, even though it wasn't at night, it was in fairly bright daylight, and this was, I think, in round about the end of November when this happened, November 41. And I thought this stream of bullets was Percival opening fire, but it wasn't. He was firing at us. And we dropped these bombs and blew the ship out of the water, and the other two aircraft came in, Beauforts, and dropped bombs as well on what was left of it. And I was looking on there's something wrong on the starboard engine. I could see it was streaming oil. And I looked along the... Now, what happened was that as we came out of the dive, Percival said to me, "You're all right in there, Nesbitt?" I said, "Yes, I'm all right." But I said, "There's something wrong on the... on the starboard side was a line of bullet holes along the leading edge and the starboard engine streaming oil." And we were in some difficulties, but fortunately, it was one of the first flights of the Beaufort 2, which had the Wasp engines instead of the Taurus engines, and it could fly on one engine. So I laid out a course for the nearest point on the British coast for us to get back. I wouldn't like flying on one engine, there was a Spitfire alongside us, and I signalled in Morse, starboard engine US, or something like that. And he didn't take any notice. I later discovered it was a Czech pilot. He probably couldn't speak English, let alone know Morse. Anyway, he flew off. I suppose he had to fly off, but I didn't like to see him go, because if we came down the sea, I would want him to report us. But he disappeared. I suppose he'd running out of fuel. And we sort of came back, closed down the one engine and came back. Curiously enough, I wasn't somehow in the least perturbed, but it was one amusing episode, because the place where we came over the coast was something called Galston, near Yarmouth. Now, when I was a child, for our holidays, our father always used to take us to Galston for our holidays, and we'd be there on the beach. I never used to like those beach holidays very much, but I was certainly extremely glad to see Galston on that occasion. I've never been back to Galston. It was quite a nice beach, and it wasn't so crowded as other more popular beaches, which my father didn't like. So I had three brothers, and we used to sport ourselves and make sandcastles on Galston. But there you are. This is where we made our landing at Coltishall again. And I went out to look at the front of the aircraft, and to my amazement, there was a whole stream of bullets around my position where I was seating. But I was... Somehow these bullets had missed me. How the hell they'd missed me, I don't know. I still can't work it out. There was a whole perforation of bullet holes at the lower part of the nose. They must have gone underneath me. I know that what happened was that Percival took off his flying boot and showed me something, and one bullet had gone through his flying boot and up the other side and made a bluish mark on his ankle. And he could feel this, and that's why he called to me when wanted to know if I was okay. He thought I was probably killed in the nose, but I wasn't. And because the aircraft was completely US, we flew back as passengers in another aircraft. But that was the only daylight attack that I made. In the course of the my career, we were divided eventually into two sort of flights, because torpedo-trained crews arrived, and they formed one flight, and we formed the dive-bombing flight. It wasn't strictly like that all the time, because sometimes the torpedo-trained people could make dive-bombing, but they tended to make the... And this was in the latter part of 1941 when these chaps arrived. They made these attacks on occasions with torpedoes. And sure enough, they did sink some ships, quite effectively, but they went out with fighter escort, usually off the Dutch coast, and did some damage. Later on, I was called in and told I was too expired. And this was sometime, I suppose, late November, December. I haven't got it exactly in my logbook. And I can remember being extremely surprised and relieved. And Percival was the same. He was too expired, or considered too expired. But I wasn't posted away immediately. I was put on administrative jobs helping the adjutant. I was always given these additional jobs, as I say, possibly because they thought I was suitable for it. But I now know that it was because I was waiting for an instructor's course. But while we were there, while I was still on the squadron, we were posted up to the north of Scotland. And we were posted to a satellite of Wick called Skitton, just south of John O'Groats. And the idea was that by that time, most of the remaining crews were torpedo trained. I was one of the oldest inhabitants in the squadron, although still doing some administrative work. But we were supposed to torpedo the Tirpitz. And on one day, the Tirpitz was out of Trondheim Fjord, and a detachment was sent to Sumburgh. And they were told that as the torpedo came back into Tirpitz, they had to go and have a go at it. I think there were something like 6 or 8 aircraft ready to take off. I wasn't one of them, of course. But anyway, there was one little snag. There was enough fuel to get there, but enough fuel to get back. So if anybody survived the attack, they were told to jump out over Sweden. And this was something like January or February 1942, in the middle of winter. And if you can imagine, any survivors with pine trees coming up underneath them, going down into thick snow, that was going to be a one-way ticket for the whole squadron, really. But at the last moment, it was cancelled because the weather closed in. But that was a sort of operation in which they felt Beauforts were suitable.
Can I just ask you about the dive bombing of the ship in Holland? With it being a daylight, can you just give me a few more details about how you approached and how you dive bombed that ship? How you approached it, what levels you were at, that sort of thing?
Well, we came absolutely straight at it. I saw the thing and said, there it is. I thought it was the ship that was we were intended to sink. But apparently it wasn't. I think it was a merchant ship we were supposed to ship. So, but it was a harbour defence vessel, which was armed. And we dived straight into the flak which came up from it.
What height did you dive in from?
Oh, we dropped from very low level. We flew. The system was, if you did that sort of thing, you flew over the vessel, then turn round. And we dived down from, I suppose, we must have been 1,000 feet straight at it. And we didn't jink about as we went in, and it drew a clean bead on us and fired at us, machine gun fire. And may have been cannon fire as well, I don't know, but some machine gun fire which caught us. And that was the method. Then the system was that you had to fly over the ship. I know on one occasion, when one of these torpedo bomber pilots, a chap called Arthur Aldridge, dive bombed a ship, he flew over it, having released his bombs, but his port wing, I think it was, caught the bracing wire and tore the end of the wing off, and he came back with this bit torn off the end of his wing. He flew all the way back, landed safely. But that's how we did it. I mean, we flew smack over the ship. We could see it before the bombs went off. We were over the ship, looking at the gunners firing at us, and then turned round, and the next one was. And then the bombs went off, and the others were waiting for our bombs to go off, and then they dived in and so on. But they were only diving a ship which had had it anyway. I forget how many people we killed on the ship, but there was a fair few.